Hello and welcome to the News Club podcast, where we talk about the news and more importantly, what to do about it. Today I'm with Debs and this week we're joined by John Bosco Nwobo, a lead campaigner at We Own It, a UK-based nonprofit fighting for public services run for people, not profit. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the campaign itself, the importance of public ownership of essential services, and what needs to be done to further reclaim democratic control over said services, aka how do we recreate the commons? But first, in a couple of sentences, who are you, John Bosco?
Hi, everyone. I am John Bosco Nwobo. I'm lead campaigner at We Own It. Oh, sorry, you already said that. Well, my role at We Own It involves identifying, because of our approach to campaigning, we are really keen not just on raising an issue, but we kind of approach from the point of view of can we get a win on this? So my job is to identify problems in public services where, for example, there is talk of privatizing a service that's currently in public ownership, or where we spot an opportunity to force a service that is currently in private hands to be brought back into public hands. Yes, and I put together a strategy, and my job involves executing that strategy. And perhaps we could talk in some more detail over the course of this about some of that work. But yes, that's...
Absolutely. And about yourself, like, what brings you to that space? What prompted you to be part of We Own It?
So I first came to Britain in September of 2017 to study for a PhD at Sussex. And while I was there, I got involved with the renters union in Brighton, in the city, because obviously I'm a renter. And it takes all of 15 minutes to realize all of the problems wrong with the rental, quote unquote, market in Britain, with landlords not fixing problems, trying to evict people without any good reason, just because they can. And I felt that it was a really, really powerful thing that there is an organization that does, roughly speaking, what unions do, or at the very least, what unions are supposed to be doing, right? Which is representing the interests of people who share a certain kind of set of interests, right? In this case, renters. So I found that idea incredibly powerful. So I joined up, I got really involved, helped lead campaigns, stopping, for example, the eviction of an old lady in Worthing. And at some point I discovered We Own It. At the time, Jeremy Corbyn was a leader of the Labour Party, and We Own It was really involved in kind of putting together Labour's public ownership policies. And I was also very involved in the Labour Party, and that was the context of my discovering them. And I thought, I really want to be involved with this organization. I believe that public services, and sometimes people don't think about housing as one of those, but I think housing is an important public service. Anything that we need to live a civilized life, right? And that includes education, healthcare, housing, food as well, even if our market economy doesn't appear to think of food as a necessity in that way, are all things that should not be subjected to the whims of the market. The market's logic being that you get what you're entitled to based on your quote-unquote ingenuity in the market. The reality is that everyone is entitled to food regardless of their ingenuity in the market. To participate in the market, you need to have fed yourself. So it's kind of a pre-step to the market in some ways. Yeah, so I got involved with We Own It. And then sometime down the line, I saw an advert for a job, for a lead campaigner job. I applied for it and I've been here now 5 years, this month, actually.
Amazing. That's brilliant. That's really brilliant. I think it's quite a relatable experience, right? You get involved with one thing and all of a sudden you're like, right, this is what I can dedicate a lot of my time and life to. And I think that's super, super powerful. Now, going to the question that I usually start off with every podcast is, what should be headline news but isn't? Because as you know, this is very much a podcast where we talk about the news, but we want to kind of recreate how we come to understand it. And with this question, really, it's not so much about a specific story so much as it is what narratives are missing, like what in essence should be spoken about en masse. What do we want people to be knowing about and why?
Oh, this is a really, really good question. And I thought about it a great deal before this podcast. There are so many different options one could go with. Obviously, because I'm a campaigner, I'm exposed to a great many stories that the press is not covering, and therefore a lot of people don't know about them. But I thought the main one that I wanted to focus on, and it's really useful that you mentioned it's not just about a specific story, it could be about a narrative, is the fact that the government's 10-year plan for health, which was recently launched, I believe, it was launched on the 4th of July, proposes to reopen the NHS to, they're now calling it public-private partnerships, but in effect, it's PFI again. And for people who don't know what PFI is, it was a policy that was started under John Major, but was radically expanded under Tony Blair, where a public project is identified, but instead of the government spending, making the investment to build that project, they went to the private sector and asked them to make that investment. And in exchange, that public service would pay back the money that the private companies spent over a period of 25, 30 years. And what we've seen, obviously, is that public services have ended up being incredibly ripped off and damaged by it. We did some new research recently, a few months ago, that found that at the highest end, some NHS trusts were paying back around 27 times the initial capital investment that was put into building those facilities. And those private companies were making hundreds of millions of pounds in profits that we know about, right? Because there are all sorts of really interesting financial engineering that can make a profit not look like a profit. But we know that they've made hundreds of millions of pounds in profit. Everybody now agrees that PFI was a disaster. Even the Conservative Party agreed in 2018, they officially ended all new PFI contracts. Well, they said, we're saying goodbye to PFI. The government is now trying to reverse that, but do so in a very sneaky way that people won't associate with PFI. Now, what I think the press needs to be talking about a lot more that they are not is the fact that the government said verbatim in their manifesto with Labour, and I want to be really really clear, I guess, it, and in the manifesto, it's clear that they're talking about the NHS, will always be publicly owned and publicly funded, right? That is a clear, simple, explicit promise that they made in their 2024 manifesto. If they ended up doing this thing that they're proposing to do of opening the NHS, and the Financial Times reported this Monday that there have been sounding out private finance investors about getting involved, if they ended up doing this, they would have broken that promise explicitly. And it is really, really important that people are talking about not just the impact of PFI in the short and long term, but also that this Labour government has practically broken every promise they made.
Which is the usual course of things.
Yeah, and in some cases, the promises that they haven't broken are some of the worst policies that they have, right? So it needs to be talked about a great deal more. And part of my job over the next number of months is to make sure that it begins to be talked about a great deal more. Yeah.
Brilliant. Now, speaking to that work itself, I guess on the economic perspective, we can see the ways in which privatization has affected the NHS specifically. But on the whole, what does it tend to do to like every basic necessity that we have?
Well, there are a number of ways one can approach that argument, right? And one of them I've already touched on earlier on. There is a kind of philosophical point to be made that public services, things that we need to survive, we all need health, we all need water, we all need energy, we all need schools, and we all need food, should not be subjected to a framework in which somebody else stands to make profit. And even more damagingly, where our access to those things is very much dependent on somebody else's ability to make profit from it, right? And so that's the philosophical point. And I think the vast majority of people in Britain would agree with that. But there are also really practical examples of privatization being really bad across all services, but I'm going to focus on the NHS in this response. So for example, there's some research that shows that NHS hospitals that are cleaned by private cleaning companies, cause more infections in the patients in the hospital than those that are cleaned by the NHS. And the reason for that is quite obvious, right? A lot of these private companies want to cut costs because that's how they make profit. And the result of that is that they hire too few people to do the job. They give them too few cleaning supplies and equipment to do the job. And they don't spend the money to actually train them properly. The hospital environment is a really specialized environment that requires everything about it, including the person, the porter who is moving patients from one place to the other. It's a really specialized skill. You have to do it right. And because they're trying to make profits, they cut all sorts of corners and it produces this kind of effect. There's obviously also some Oxford research a few years ago that suggested that linked the preventable deaths of hundreds of people in the NHS directly to privatization. And there are a lot of stories of these people who were sent to private hospitals to get treatment, and because the private hospitals don't have emergency or post-operative care, those people developed some kind of complication and there were delays in transferring them to an NHS hospital. I like to put it this way, that if you went to a private hospital and while you were getting treatment, say you had what would be a simple illness, you had a headache, which most people don't go to hospitals for, but let's say you went to the hospital and while you were in the private hospital, a microwave accidentally fell on your foot, they wouldn't treat you, they'd put you in an ambulance and take you to an NHS hospital, because they don't have the facilities to treat those serious conditions. And why don't they have those facilities? They're expensive and they're not profitable. And so it's really, really clear that involving the private companies in whatever service, whether you're talking about water, whether you're talking about rail, the government is taking train operating companies into public ownership, but they could be doing far more. There are other parts of the railway system that they're planning to leave in private hands. We are campaigning on that as well. And so it's really, really important that people are getting actively involved in the question of who's running their public services. I wanted to finish up by putting this in some really broader context, it's a kind of grand narrative. In 2008, we had the global economic crash. And obviously, that crash was caused by all sorts of financial shenanigans by the wealthiest people in the world, and by consequence, of course, the wealthiest people in Britain, the same kind of people who are running a lot of our public services, and some of those companies were directly involved, private equity companies, for example. And what was the result of that? Austerity. We've had now 20 years or so of austerity. And in practice, austerity actually just meant cutting the services that the public depends on so badly that they underperform. And as a result of underperforming, that is used as a rationale for privatizing those services. Who then benefits again from the kind of antidote to the crash? The same people who caused the crash. And so it's really important that people are seeing what's happening with public services as, in many ways, that perennial battle between the most powerful, the richest, the most highly connected people who are able to get a minister on the phone and maneuver themselves a government contract, whether it's public service or for the provision of goods, like we saw in the COVID pandemic. The same people who were responsible for the crash and benefited from it are then now coming around. It's almost like a double tap bombing, coming around to pick at the carcasses of the public services that they themselves had created the environment for underfunding. And people need to start thinking of this as that kind of inequality battle, that battle between the richest and the poorest, between those that actually depend on public services for their lives and those that can do without them because they can easily get a private service for all of those things, right? They're able to get the best healthcare in the world. They can go anywhere they want for it. They can send their children to schools that they can pay fees for and all of that, right? So it's really important that it's put in that context.
Absolutely. And I guess speaking to that battle, Debs, as well, like I know you've done a bit of work on commons, on recreating commons, or like speaking to non-privatization, speaking to public ownership. What can that look like?
Well, so I've just read a copy of Keir Milburn's book called Radical Abundance, which is coming out soon. And it's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't actually clocked that thing of the transition from why are they calling it public-private partnerships now, the thing that used to be PFI? And it's really helpful that you've just explained that. And it's also interesting that the justification for it seems to have changed. That's what Keir talks about. In the days of PFI, the reasoning, the explicit reasoning was the private sector is more efficient. We're going to get them to do this thing because they're going to do it better than we would. Whereas the real reason was to do with, you know, making the books look a certain way and also a general allegiance to like increasing private power. Whereas now the justification is we don't have any money and they're the ones who've got the money. So it's a real like, you know, please, please, Mr. BlackRock, come and save us. Like, we don't have any money and you're the one that can like give us the money. And because we're so we're so desperate for this thing that only you have, we're going to take on all of the risk and we absolutely guarantee you this profit. And of course, taking on that risk means both that we will cover your ass in terms of money, but also, like you're saying, it's the risk of increased infection rate because they've cut corners. It's the risk that, you know, your schools end up falling down and concrete might fall on a child's head. Like, you know, that was another like impact of PFI. So yeah, and then what Keir talks about in the book is this other model of public commons partnership. And it's trying to say, if now the justification is not that the private sector is going to do it better, but just because they're seen as the only ones that can do it at all, and the state is saying, we're just going to step in and take the risk, why not have the state de-risk communities coming together and doing things for themselves? So one of the examples that they give is, you know, the campaign to save the Latin village in Seven Sisters in North London, and how, you know, it's this big market that has existed in this building for decades, and like for two decades they were fighting a private developer, and the private developer did pull out like 5 years ago, and they've developed this community plan. And because the market is in this building that's owned by Transport for London, it's in a building that is literally above the train line, so it makes sense for TfL to continue to have ownership of the building and to continue to hold the risk of the building, because ultimately they will always have to hold that risk. If you run a train line underneath the road, you can't hand that over actually to a private developer and say, well, yeah, if you fuck it up, that's on you. It's actually on everybody. So then, you know, they've been trying to create this model of like, you've got TfL here and their role is to hold the risk. And then you've got the Market Traders Association who can run the market. And then there'll be a surplus from that. And that surplus goes to a community development trust. And then the community development trust, that's the kind of commons bit, can decide how to use that. And they might use that to set up new kind of commons based enterprises. They might decide to just, I don't know, you could imagine a situation where they're like, we're going to create a universal basic income for our people or whatever, like if you got to a certain scale. And so, yeah, I think, and a lot of what they're saying is that the two really important bits of it is the kind of community autonomy bit, where people are actually getting to experience having a say over this surplus, and then also the impact on the public sector of working alongside community actors, which, you know, they're kind of saying a big part of the impact of PFI was that civil servants were working alongside people from the private sector, and it wasn't just affecting how they thought about that particular project, it was affecting how they thought about all of their work and how the state should run. And saying, well, how do you get civil servants to work alongside communities and then be influenced in the whole way that they think about what the state should be doing and what their job is like through that interaction?
That is brilliant. And what about the We Own It campaigns? Like, what successes have you been able to see there? And like, have you been able to witness, as Debs is kind of referring to here, like that different actors coming together and making something happen, realizing something such that it starts to, again, be part of something that is in common ownership?
Yes. I mean, we have a whole list of wins on our website because we really care about wins, right? There are some organizations who approach their work in terms of, here is a problem, it's a really important issue. Regardless of whether we can win, we're going to kind of take it on, even if just to raise the issue publicly. And that's incredibly valuable. And we work with a lot of those kinds of organizations. Our approach is really wins oriented, because we think that the more wins you get, the more you're able to show to people who are getting involved what Debs was just talking about, that ability to demonstrate that people have the ability to run things, or that people have the ability to win things. And in a time such as we are in, it's really, really important, right? Because politics is incredibly depressing at the moment. We just had, or the public just had, a big fight with the government over disability cuts. And that was really empowering for a lot of people because it forced the government to retreat somewhat from what they were looking to do. And that empowers people to go for more. I mean, just to highlight one example, the fact that the government is bringing rail into public ownership is an example of a win that We Own It and other organizations have fought for over the years and have now begun to get the wins on. But the one that I wanted to highlight that I think contains the seeds of how we approach a lot of the other work we do is a campaign that was run 2 years ago, I think it was, if I remember correctly. I don't have the best memory. after an American corporation, Seen, took over a number of GP surgeries in London, they bought them from another GP partnership. So GPs can be members of partnerships, and typically GPs are, in the most general of terms, independent businesses, right? So, but there are a lot of rules that they have to live under from the NHS. They sold their business, quote unquote, to Centene, and a campaign arose from NHS campaigners, local and regional and national, to put pressure on the local NHS bodies to reverse that decision. And I was really, really impressed by how everybody came together. We organized, for example, with four surgeries in Islington, in the north and south, that were sold to Centene. And we organized a local community event. At the time, we did it on Zoom, because obviously, for obvious reasons. And it was attended by hundreds of people, if I remember correctly, at least 200 people. Local people who are not campaigners, they're just people who care about their local surgeries. It was attended by all of the councillors representing the areas. It was attended by the two MPs, Jeremy Corbyn and Emily Thornberry. And we, in that meeting, got everybody in attendance to write a personalized message that we have a system that we use for doing this that went directly to the decision makers at the local, what was at the time called the CCG, the Clinical Commissioning Group. Although they were not able to get Centene to reverse the sale, what has happened is that because the local CCG has to renew contracts, they decided the year after not to renew the contract for that company running the service, right? So that was a win that was secured by everybody. We own it, local NHS campaigners, keep our NHS public campaigners, the local councillors, the MPs. One of the local councillors actually challenged the decision for the sale at the High Court and didn't get a good result, but it showed that people were willing to take on the fight. And at the end, they won. And I feel that was an example of how coming together, being really smart and strategic, because that's really important, not to just do things because somebody needs to do something, but doing something because you know what the mechanisms for achieving change are. You know who is the person who's making the decision and what they themselves have to consider in making that decision. And your job then becomes crafting a campaign that gives them, that answers all the questions they have for making that decision in order to make it as easy as possible if they're not kind of otherwise ideologically opposed to making that decision, to make that decision. So I thought it was a really, really good campaign, and it's one that I'm really proud of.
Thank you so much for sharing, and I really appreciate it as well. And as you're talking, I keep thinking about other work, because you mentioned their NHS contracts, and basically there's this multi-stakeholder cooperative called Sign Allies Co-op, who provide BSL translation services for deaf people, like across different, who need it across different kind of sectors. And the biggest sector that they serve and have is the NHS and like medical contracts, basically. Their service is a really good example of how deaf people, interpreters or communication professionals and investors then become part of what is essentially a business that is centering the needs of the people that actually require that service, such that it's being contracted out to this service, one that actually cares about deaf people, one that is led by and created by deaf people and interpreters. And I think it's really cool. It's a really good example of how we also start to kind of bring together different elements of what makes up actually a public service, like who owns this. This is a multi-stakeholder cooperative, and using these kind of structures that really, like, again, allow us to center our needs around democratic principles rather than the simple need or the simple desire to generate profit from, as you say, what is basic necessities of life. And in the case of deaf people, this is very much a basic need. It's like the bare minimum. And to be able to have a service that actually cares about the specifics, I think is also really beautiful. So just shout out to Sign Allies who are doing that work, and I'm pretty sure are very unique in doing that work. So I'm going to move to the last two questions that we like to ask everyone here, which is, what would you bring to the online news club? So in 9 days, on the 20th of September, we're going to be hosting News Club Live, where it's basically a news club-esque format online. We're asking you basically, what would you bring, whether that's a news story, whether that's a publication, whether that's a physical object, whether that's food, what would you bring?
I really think that the websites of campaigning organizations are a really underrated resource. Campaigning organizations who are involved with campaigning organizations are often the most knowledgeable people about that specific issue. They care enough about it to devote their time, their free time to it. In Water, for example, some of the organizations that we've been working with to fight for Thames Water to be taken into public ownership, Windrush against sewage pollution, River Action UK, I think are two organizations whose blogs, whose websites are much more informative on the issue of water than any news outlet out there. And on the NHS, I would say that Keep Our NHS Public's website, their blogs, are far more informative than anything you will find in the mainstream press. So I think if I were in 10 days' time attending the club, I would take with me one of the latest stories that was done on the blog of a Windrush against sewage pollution, which was essentially a response to a review that was done by John Cunliffe into the water industry, which had been banned from even considering public ownership as an option. And I thought that their response to that was really powerful and really knowledgeable. And it's important that people are seeing those alternative views, which you will not see in the mainstream press, which are animating those that have decided to take time out of their lives to do this work that everyone stands to benefit from.
Love that. We're always very much advocators for different news sources, independent news sources, the kind of places where we're getting information that isn't just the usual mainstream copy-pasted shite. And what about yourself, Devs? What would you bring?
I wonder if I would bring something, if it's on this theme that was definitely not news, I would bring some history. And I'm thinking specifically, I live in Sheffield, the context here. Like for us, you know, WeOwnIt was really involved in the campaign in Manchester to make the buses better. And the buses in Manchester are now amazing.
They're better.
And the buses in Sheffield are so shit. And like the franchise is coming back into public ownership. And so there is a route forward. But people will often say how great the buses used to be. And they, you know, they'll talk about 2 penny bus fares back in the 80s or whatever. And I would actually love to sit down with the old route maps and be like, what used to be here? And what could this look like in the future? And how could you also think more creatively? Like, I think buses are a really important part of it. But also, how could you be thinking about car sharing as like part of the future of this? Or yeah, one thing that I find really inspiring about WeOwnIt is that, yeah, it's not just these defensive campaigns. It's like sometimes it is about fighting privatization, but it is also about thinking in a new way about what the future of this thing looks like. It's not just about the old like top-down public sector, the state knows best thing. It is actually about this much more like collaborative and like deeply democratic way of providing the things that we all need.
Can I just quickly add to that two things, actually? On water, we recently put together, working with Compass, people should, if you don't know what Compass is, it's an organization that also campaigns to protect public services. Working with Compass, we put together what we call the Thames Water Emergency Board, which was our way of essentially creating a shadow example of what Thames Water can look like if it's run in public ownership, in 21st century municipal ownership, right? And that brought together local authority councillors, it brought together workers, it brought together households that use services in the area. And under a system that would be managed kind of democratically, it would bring together experts, small businesses that depend on water for their livelihood, bring together everybody to make sure that there are voices in the room who know how things work, i.e. the experts, and know how things actually play out at the receiver end of things, i.e. the households, right? And another example is, at the moment, we are lobbying the government and MPs hard on what more they can do on rail. The government is tabling their railways bill at the beginning of November, and we are campaigning for what we're calling a passenger voice, essentially for a body that is going to be a membership organization for passengers. Once you buy a ticket, you become a member of that organization. And what that means is that you're entitled to cast a vote for people who are going to then go sit on the board that will be running the new railway system, the Great British Railway, as the government has called it. And these are examples that I think really illustrate that participation, that democratic ownership and control, which is almost just as important as ownership. And yes, it shows that we are not sitting here saying the government can run everything. I can guarantee you that the government and the professionals that run things through the government can run it better than private companies, because they only care about one thing. They care about the service, and private companies care about shareholders and profit. But the people can run it even better, right? So that's what we're saying. 21st century public ownership involves bringing people together to own, control, and run the things that they depend on.
I could not have put it better myself. That is brilliant. And now, looking to 2029, within this 21st century context, the reason we say 2029 is because we may, and in many ways are already, living in a Europe and UK that is run by authoritarians. So in light of this extended political context, what is the one thing everyone should do leading up to 2029?
Well, that's a big question. I would say get more and more involved with campaigning, because I think that we have a really good runway to 2029 to empower ourselves against whatever it is coming at the other end of that general election. Whatever happens after that general election, we are going to be far better off if we are empowered as a group, as opposed to if we're just individuals sitting in our houses complaining about all the things that are going wrong. So I think my suggestion is get involved with organizations that are campaigning to save the services that your community needs, organizations that are campaigning to empower people in your community. That is the only way that you can fight back against whatever it is that's coming at the other end of that election, whether it's Labour winning again or Reform winning, whatever it is, really.
And what about you, Tebs? What do you think?
Yeah, I think in this context, I think there's something really important about constantly hammering this thing of like Reform are not just right wing in the sense of like hating immigrants. They are right wing in the sense that they believe in privatization and they want to steal all your money, and actually really hammering that point home. And I know people are really trying to do that. They're trying to expose the way that Farage is in bed with the private sector, but also not personalizing it around him, right? It's like actually, you know, where Reform are winning councillors, like constantly pushing them, not just on their racism, but actually on their, like, what is their economic vision? And I think that's also where, you know, the Green Party and the new Your Party and, the, you know, actually creating that compelling alternative economic thing that you can then turn to Reform and say, well, what do you think about this? Why are you opposed to this alternative that's actually on the table? So they're not always setting the terms of the debate. I think that's that thing of like what they would do with the NHS is probably their biggest weak point. So yeah, focusing in on that alongside, like you're saying, John Bosco, like them being part of conversations where you're really trying to build and imagine and work towards a future where you actually have taken back control of your own public services and the things that you need.
A future that looks really beautiful and bright. I mean, because all of these little things, depending on whichever city you're in, whichever region you're in, are really contingent on those specific spaces, right? Like there are such different environmental factors that then mean that we can then have access to certain kind of different things. But just remembering that it is possible, right? Remembering that all these things are viable and that we see them, and looking at, for example, like things that are outside of the UK as well. I cannot wait for the day that I don't pay £100 to travel to London. I think we kind of spoke to this in the last episode on community energy, where if we're able to own these things, specifically energy, it's like if we're able to, within a given street, have the energy be ours, then we're spending less money on paying the energy bill to the companies that are just like extracting all the profit they can. And therefore, like all of a sudden, not having to spend so much money on basic things just becomes a norm. And I look forward to seeing that. And I really, really love seeing all the wins that, as you say, We Own It is able to achieve, and also the future imagination and like possibilities in terms of how things can be and will be, right? And absolutely will be. So thank you so much for your time, Debs. Thank you for your time, John Bosco. Really appreciate you coming on and making it possible. And any final words?
Well, get involved with We Own It at weownit.org.uk. get involved with Keep Our NHS Public at keeperNHSPublic.com, I think is the website. You could just Google it. Get involved with all of these organizations. Fight for the public services that you need to live.
And yeah, I just needed to say, I was describing Keir Milburn's book as just his because he's coming to do an event. So I've just been thinking about it as his. But it's actually co-authored by Keir Milburn, Kai Herron and Bertie Russell. Yeah. And Radical Abundance will be out, I think, in a few weeks.
Amazing. All right. So go read Radical Abundance and definitely check out all the links. We'll have them in the podcast description as well for We Own It. And as per usual, subscribe to our newsletter. We have a bi-weekly newsletter releasing interesting info on news, inspiration for your news clubs, which you better have set up by now. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. That's us at News Club UK _ episodes every week. Look forward to the next series soon to come out as well, as we explore different things with more people. Thank you again, and I'll catch you soon. Bye.